Eric.
Hey, Charles. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. What's going on?
All right. Well, we're doing another interview in our series, Checking In with Eric Meyer.
Yep.
And you know what?
What?
We are super successful because the Google folks are imitating us. Look at this. Okay. What do you see there?
Okay. Let me zoom in on this.
Let's zoom in on this.
Okay.
A blonde person, you know, with the tie-dye, interviewing a celebrity.
Excellent.
And look for today. I even kind of, you know, matched my tie-dye. You see?
Let me get it.
Perfect match.
Nice. And she has blonde hair.
Blonde hair. And even her name is the same as mine. Or sounds the same. Meyer, Meyer. You know, you don't even hear the difference. So,
dude.
We did great.
You know, we always do great things. For there's a thing going on in a conference right now, and they decided to say the Java Renaissance. Remember the C++
yes.
Renaissance thing we pimped on Channel 9? This is amazing. Meyer, Meyer, tie-dye. So who is our celebrity today?
Jeff Wilcox. He is... okay. Silver Light. His hair is not gray, but you know, he works on Silver Light.
Okay.
It's not that you get gray hair from Silver Light, but it's like silver hair.
Actually, I think we might.
You
silver
might?
Hair.
Okay.
It's possible.
Okay. And so he works on Silver Light for the phone.
Okay.
Which I have spent a lot of hours on as well.
Of course you have.
So this should be a great conversation today.
Excellent.
So, Jeff, what the first question I always ask is, how did you enter the field? How did you become a computer scientist or a programmer?
I wonder, you probably always get the same answer. It's been
but usually it has to do with BASIC. But
yeah, it's been a long time. Back with the 286 and BASIC, for sure. But I really got into software as a business in middle school. So I started a little bit of a developer tools framework for Visual Basic developers. It was written in C++, and I sold it on America Online.
Uh-huh.
It was shareware in the early days.
Wow.
And so I guess the big thing for me, though, was the one day that I had a couple checks that I got in the mail, and I went to my parents asking, how do I deposit checks? And they were surprised that I'd been accepting checks, apparently, to start with, but that's how I got into software.
So. Okay, and so nice. So this is kind of interesting, building developer tools in C++ for Visual Basic in middle school. I think a lot of developers, you know, even after they graduate, you know, they still don't reach that phase. So, and where did you go to college?
University of Michigan.
And did you study computer science?
I did. Yep.
In college, what was your favorite topic or your favorite course?
My favorite course. I liked my French class a lot, actually. Beautiful women. But more appropriately on the CS side, there's a web programming class, and it was really, really fun. I went into it with a lot of web development experience, and I think the class was maybe a little bit of a cakewalk, but a bunch of us met, and I've got some lifelong friends now that I met in that class, and we went to do things together. Everyone moved to Seattle. It's been really fun.
But, you know, you were joking about the French, but I do believe that there's a big correspondence between, you know, being able to communicate in natural language and explain things and programming.
Oh,
do you
definitely.
Believe that there's a correlation
sure,
there?
Surely. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's like, interestingly, and we should definitely also interview them, the guys in RISE, where they do the evidence-based software engineering.
Nice.
One of the things that they discovered, for example, is that people that have studied music are best at doing code reviews. So it's like it's always the kind of, you know, the unexpected things there. So you went to college, and then how did you end up at Microsoft with this whole gang of friends?
Yeah, so this was, you know, just typical Microsoft. I never interned here. But
oh, you never interned. That's also...
Wow.
Well, a lot of people kind of that we interviewed have interned once or twice, and so you just...
Yeah, and so I actually had some interesting experience. I did internships at a power company doing software development, working on substation design, and then I had an internship at a pharmaceutical. And so coming to Microsoft was where I really wanted to be, real software, you know. But my last year at college, I did the interview, said, hey, this is the place to be. And luckily, most of my friends did the same thing. So.
And so where did you start? Which team?
Started on ASP.NET.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what version was that?
Oh, this was ASP.NET 2. And we shipped that maybe 2 months after I started. So I had nothing to do with the product, but I got to go to the ship party.
Okay.
So I had that at least. And, you know, really soon after we started working on what eventually became Silverlight. Pretty soon. So I kind of got involved in that from day one.
And
really
so what part of Silverlight? Because Silverlight is quite broad. So
yep. So at the time, this was it was called Silverlight 1.1, and it was being built at the same time as Silverlight 1. So Silverlight 1 was JavaScript.
Yes.
1.1 was when we were looking at managed code. And so I started, actually, I was a test lead at the time. And I kind of got involved in that, testing interoperability with the browser.
Okay.
And soon after, you know, corporate reorganizations every couple months, and, you know, I was in the proper Silverlight team. So it's been fun.
And so what things have you been working on?
Quite a few different random things. I initially worked on the Silverlight toolkit from the very start. And so that was building a lot of the nice controls that developers use. And kind of the first thing people were touching were these controls. We learned a lot about that. As part of that, I wrote the Silverlight unit test framework, which was hoping to give people a way to test their apps. And that was something that actually I'm really glad I did, because everyone's using it. It's been kind of fun. And, you know, over the years, I've gone to now work on the raw parts of Silverlight. So writing the native code, I worked in the parser with a couple other guys. And that was a lot of fun.
And the parser, you mean the XAML parser? Or?
It's XAML parser, but it's actually a massive part of the code base. So we're parsing XAML, but at the same time, we're eventually taking a stream of nodes and effectively writing all these objects out. And it's so much more than just parsing. Yeah.
Okay, so can you, because, yeah, again, if you're like me, a simple guy, I look at XAML, I think that's XML. So that shouldn't be that hard to parse.
Yeah.
But now you're saying that it's kind of really hard. So what? Where's the difficulties there?
Well, it seems really simple.
And yeah.
I wish it was. I did not design the initial parser. I just fixed bugs on it and worked on it. But the initial guys did some smart work to just read through that file once, so we never have to look again at something we've seen.
Okay.
And so that gives us really good startup perf. And one of the things is that you can express XAML in a lot of ways. You can have an XML attribute that says, my visibility is collapsed. And that's easy to type.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also have what's called property element syntax. And so you have a whole other XML element that's called, you know, visibility. And then you can set properties in there, and you can even have an entire tree of objects that are effectively set to a property. And so doing that at a parsing level is pretty complicated. Either that or we've introduced a lot of bugs along the way. So it's a very complex thing, actually.
And so the parser and all those things, is that written in managed or native code?
It's all native code, and there's a little bit of interop with managed code as well. And so when we look at that, you know, if we need to instantiate a C# object, obviously we have to go to .NET and say, hey, CLR, give me a new object. However, almost everything's in native in Silverlight, and that's for performance reasons, and it really, you know, it really helps things go fast that way. And the whole graphic stack is, you know, also C++.
And so we kind of, you know, see that a lot, where people have to, you know, make a choice between managed and native. So you say it's performance. So can you drill down a little bit more into there? What kind of, which areas do you, you know, gain performance that you would lose when you would use managed code?
Yeah, I think it's a two-way street, actually. Yeah. There are situations where managed code is so much faster. And if you look at Silverlight, we're doing rich data binding. And that's just something that in C is really difficult. There's no idea of metadata. And in managed code, we have that. So data binding is just really quick in C#.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at C++, and we're looking at just trying to move through massively this huge graphics tree and just processing nodes off of that as quickly as possible. We need to talk to the GPU. And that basically says we need to be either in assembly code or at C at that point. We're just talking to a device driver or DirectX. And so it just makes perfect sense. It needs to be in C++.
Mm-hmm.
And to do it in C# would just slow things down a little bit. And that's kind of what we learned of WPF. WPF was almost all in managed code, except for the raw graphics part.
So now, the interesting thing is, like, you know, if you're running on the regular CLR, then, you know, you can write C++ and native code as well.
Yep.
But so do you envision something that if you write a Silverlight app that, you know, if necessary, you can also call into native and maybe do that in a safe way or in a sandboxed way?
Yep. So far we definitely haven't done that, but we're actually looking at Silverlight 5, allowing you to p-invoke into native code. And so that'll allow developers to do a whole lot more. People want to talk to, like, a barcode reader on a computer,
mm-hmm.
and you can't do that with Silverlight today, really. So in the future, that's going to happen. Silverlight 5, we've talked about quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
is going to support this. So we're getting closer, but I think security is kind of our biggest concern. We thankfully don't have a lot of issues with security. It's a pretty solid product. We have a great process in place, but, you know, we always worry about that. So we'll see where it goes. And I know some of our competitors are starting to introduce native code in the browser.
Yes,
too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very interesting, actually.
Yeah. which in some sense the browser is becoming the kind of, you know, container for apps and for graphics.
It really does, yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the things, you know, that also I think you, that was introduced in Silverlight 4 is the kind of interaction with HTML. Is there anything there that, you know, because there's like, you know, you are talking about the GPU, which is like one side of the graphics, but then there's also, you know, the kind of the more high-level side.
Yep.
And can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, so we actually do have, the first feature I worked on in Silverlight 1.1 was actually talking to the HTML down.
Yes.
And that feature is really, it has never changed. It works great. People have built entire, almost HTML apps in Silverlight, actually,
yep.
which is a unique concept. But at this point, you know, we're looking towards the future. Everyone's talking about HTML5. And I think right now it's differentiated. I don't think people are necessarily saying, let's have Silverlight and HTML5 in the same app. It's kind of, you pick one and go with it. But, you know, I'm sure smarter people than I are thinking about it. So.
Okay. Yeah. Because that is, you know, I spent quite a lot of time also doing Silverlight apps with HTML UI. So the... Like, I don't know if that's something that, you know, where if you look at HTML, what I like there is that there's a very kind of direct correspondence between the DOM and, you know, the code that you program against that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm a low level guy, right? So I like to kind of have very little magic. Whereas if you look at XAML, there's, you know, as you mentioned, all the data binding and so on. So there's like a greater distance between what you write in code and what you write in markup.
Yeah.
So there's the kind of value is there in the declarative nature of the markup.
Yep.
So what is your opinion about that?
I really like XAML.
Okay.
I think we're making it clear that designers love it. We're designer developers, whatever you want to call them, and just being able to open this up in Blend or in a design tool and being able to interact with notes, that's something that HTML's never gotten quite right. You know, if you're building a data-driven app, it's tough. You know, Dreamweaver doesn't really get you there. It really doesn't. And so I think there's this nice separation of, you know, logic and code that you can do through ViewModel. That's great. It's nice. And some developers, they swear by it. And it makes apps easier to maintain. It's a really nice story, but, you know, HTML5 is adding new features too that do some of this. So I think there's a lot of different ways to do that same scenario.
Yeah. But it's kind of interesting where, you know, is where do you put the kind of magic or the abstractions, right? Do you put that in code and in APIs, or do you kind of, you know, put that inside the markup?
Yeah.
And was there when, you know, were you involved in the design of XAML, or, and, you know, how do you decide where you put, you know, do you say I'm just putting that in code, or, you know, I'm putting this inside the markup such that, you know, maybe the designers can access it because they don't want to write code.
Like,
I'm interested in how that design process goes.
Well, so XAML, thankfully, we ripped off from WPF. And so we have a benefit in Silverlight where a lot of the code we're just stealing the code from ourselves. And so we were able to ramp up really quick. We knew XAML, it worked great. We didn't really want to change it. However, I built some controls where we've struggled with, do we have XAML declarative animations, or do we do it in code? And we've actually gone both ways, kind of depending on performance considerations or just what we're trying to accomplish. So in the Windows Phone, one of the controls is called the pivot control, and it's kind of like a tab control. So you can kind of pivot through your page views.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up doing declarative XAML for customers. If they want to animate, like when you swipe to a new item, animate it up, they can do that in XAML. But we actually do the internal animation, the manipulations when you touch it. That's all done in code. And that's just, it's a design decision we made. We thought it was cleaner, maybe less bugs would be introduced, and really, we don't want customers changing how the panning animation works. So it's kind of gone both ways there, I guess.
Okay, but I guess like with every design, there's no kind of hard way to say, you know, we put it here or we put it there.
I wish there was.
Yeah.
It's really a learning process, and we keep relearning the same things.
So, and you mentioned, you know, Silverlight for the phone. Obviously there, you know, the controls are not hosted in the browser, but in the phone.
Yep.
Was that a big change, like code-wise or architecture-wise, to take Silverlight from the browser and put it
It was a very big undertaking. So we actually started with Silverlight 3. We kind of forked that code. And we did a ton of performance changes. So the graphics stack talks straight to Direct3D. And we're talking direct to, we have like a pretty advanced compositor there. And we're able to do things off thread. So if you have a smooth animation, you know, your name is flying into the screen. Even if your CPU, your primary thread is completely pegged on the CPU, it'll still smoothly fade in. And that's something where Silverlight actually doesn't do that. We did all new work for this, having this separate thread to do animations. And it makes it look a lot nicer, and we learned a lot in the process doing that. But just tons of work for Perf, really. If you think about it, touch responsiveness is not really there for Silverlight on the computer. And the most important thing on these phones is touch. Mm-hmm. And so we learned a lot about changing the input model and responsiveness as part of that.
Yeah, so as you say, a big difference between like the browser where you're interacting with like the mouse and so on, and here where you have touch and multi-touch. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do a lot of changes in the conceptual model to deal with multi-touch? I mean, like, because you don't have like a mouse click event anymore, but you have like, you know, gestures and so on.
Yep.
Did that have a big impact?
It did, and we actually have kind of a legacy support for click. So if you take a Silverlight desktop controller that has a click event, we're able to let you, when you touch it, we can fire that event. So that's good for people that already wrote their controls and their apps and port them over. But the preferred way going forward is using these manipulation events. And it's totally different. You get a start event, you get deltas, and then a complete event. And so from us, there's work you need to do to understand, is it a touch? Is it a double tap? How are they interacting with the control? And we still are trying to figure out the best way that people expect to work. For instance, people don't discover that they can touch and hold on some elements because there's no discoverability aspect to mm-hmm. it. And so we're struggling to find the best ways, working with the designers and the UX people, to really, you know, build controls that make sense.
And so when you, like, are there any ways to take, you know, like a sequence of events and turn them into, you know, a more abstract event? Like, for example, you know, you do a swipe, or I want to, you know, go and stretch something. Mm-hmm. And there I probably don't want to see, you know, begin touch, and then, but I want to get like a higher level event.
Yep.
And do you have any ways to do that?
Yep, there's two different ways. Yeah. So we actually built in the toolkit a thing called Gesture Listener.
Okay.
And so you kind of hook this up in your code, and then all of a sudden you get more useful events like the scaling transforms that you can just apply to objects. So we kind of implemented that once. We worked with the manipulation deltas, the basis to build that, and hopefully most people never have to worry about that again. And then there's also an XNA component that the graphics and game teams built, and it's called a touch panel. And that's a very similar object, except it's kind of hooked up a little bit differently, and it makes more sense for games. And again, you just hook up to really simple events, so that there are much easier ways to deal with this stuff.
And so can you give us an impression of how many new controls did you guys write for the phone in particular? Because, you know, the UI, the form factor is very different, so I assume that, you know, you cannot just take the controls that you have for a big screen, and you have a giant screen, you know, and that's like, compared to that, that's like tiny.
Yeah. So there's two big controls we wrote, which are basically what all the navigation is based on. So one is called Panorama, and it's in the advertising. It's this big thing where you swipe, and this beautiful graphic kind of parallaxes in. And that control was pretty complicated from a touch standpoint and kind of a graphic standpoint and performance. But it looks beautiful. And then the other big control is the pivot control. And that's the one I wrote that, if you look at the mail app, it's central. It shows, you know, you have all items, you have unread items. And that was kind of a whole new model for us in the way that you interact with the control. It's touch. And we did learn a lot in building that control. And it wasn't just something we did here either. We had a team in Israel as well at Microsoft that was working on these same controls with us. And so we kind of, it was a big effort across the company to find, how do you do this the best way? And it was a lot of fun. And at the side, the toolkit also has, you know, toggle switches and all these little mm-hmm. controls that the phone defined, but that we didn't really have in Silverlight. So we did probably about 10 other controls as well.
And are these controls now kind of moving back to the kind of, you know, the Silverlight for the big screen? Or doesn't that make sense? I mean, I my guess that, you know, for example, what you see is these kind of, you know, what is it, what are they called, carousel things, you know, that you see them like on the phone and now also on many web pages. So I do believe that there might be some crossover between
them. There's convergence happening for sure. Most of our controls in the toolkit are all open source. So we have had people take them and get them running on the desktop Silverlight. Back here I have a monitor that's touchscreen, And so Silverlight supports touch events, and I'm sure if Silverlight 5, we're getting even more manipulations brought in. So eventually I think we'll see that a lot of these controls do converge. And that's good for developers. One consistent API, one control they know. And it also makes more sense as people stop using that mouse and move to touch devices.
It's good for managed developers.
Yes.
To clarify that.
Very true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I had to do it, man.
Yeah, we know, Charles.
I mean, it's important. It's an important thing. It's great to see that some of it was implemented in C++ when you needed performance.
Yeah.
Okay. So now you kind of,
I'm sorry.
I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
Check spoiled everything.
And Eric Meyer.
Yes, too many interrupts.
Okay, back to the regularly scheduled program.
Yes, I now know what I wanted to ask. Open source. So you mentioned that the controls are open source. What does that mean? And, how much do you kind of, care and feed for the community? Do you see a lot of, people enhancing the controls?
Yeah. So it's what we call the MSPL. It's the permissive license. And, or I guess the name's public license now. And you can do anything with this. I don't know if we're supposed to encourage it, but I've seen people actually use these controls in a similar way in other platforms. So it's really open. We find that our customers learn how to build controls from it. It's great. They learn, this is how Microsoft would develop a control. Look at the coding style. Look at the way that they handle these problems. People love that. And the community, there's definitely some ported projects people have forked and kind of made their own bug fixes in some situations. And it's just a really active way for people to say, hey, we're pretty transparent. And we actually have the bugs in CodePlex. And so customers open bugs that we'll triage and fix internally. And people know, this has been fixed. It'll be in the next release. So I think from a Microsoft standpoint, it's nice being transparent. I think people appreciate honest answers. And it kind of removes a little bit of that secrecy that I think people feel that Microsoft used to have. So it's great having that open source in there.
Yeah. And so when you write open source software, often when you ask a developer, can you, send me a piece of code or can you show me, they say, give me some time to clean it up. Whereas when you have open source, it's always visible for everybody. Did you notice that, knowing that your code will be open source, that you're, coding in a different way?
In an extremely different way, yeah. We have probably some of the strictest coding guidelines I've seen. A lot of it's around style, actually.
Okay.
Like, we always comment our methods because the idea is, customers see this too. It's super important. And I wish we had one of the guys on the team, Ted, here. He does the most amazing code reviews. He will sit down and just tear apart your code. And it's a great use of his time, actually, because everyone that gets torn apart in these reviews just writes better code after that. And one thing we've kind of struggled a little bit, we do have an internal depot, and so we'll do a bunch of bug fixes and then push out one update. We've tried that model, and then we've tried a different model with the phone, where we'll make a change here on my desktop, and it goes public immediately.
Okay.
And so that one's very interesting, because we're trying not to, we don't want to regress the stuff we've already shipped, but we also want people to be able to right now update their Windows Phone toolkit, get those bug fixes.
Yes.
So it's a big struggle for us. And it's really embarrassing when you check in something that doesn't work. So I know once we checked in a project file that didn't compile, and 2 minutes later on Twitter you see people complaining, hey, your code's awful, what are you guys doing? And so it's more fun, I think, actually, because customers see what we're doing, they see the check-in comments, and I think it really brings us a little closer.
Yeah. Which is also interesting, because we have seen in previous interviews the same thing, is that Twitter apparently is the kind of feedback loop, is like, there's something, a bug or something, and immediately, the tweets start flying.
Yeah. Twitter's a great way. It's been amazing. I was at some conferences in Europe late last year, and I'd never met some people, but from Twitter conversations I'd had, they'd seen my little profile picture, people come up to me and they're like, you're Jeff Wilcox. And I'm not really a celebrity. No one should know me, but I'm glad that they do, and it really helps me connect with folks. And after I come back, I still see the same people on Twitter. I have a conversation with them, and I get suggestions from them, and so I think it's really nice. We're closer to the community, even than we work with blogs. Twitter is just right there right now.
Yes. Yeah, I think the barrier is lower to communicate.
It really is, yeah.
And so another question with open source is when people submit bugs from the outside, Is there any way you can triage them, or, you know, like, say, if there's many people that are tweeting about that bug, does it get a higher priority, or do you kind of take that into account in the feedback loop?
So CodePlex has this built in, actually. So when you open a work item, there's a big vote button, and so every time we start a milestone, we do, you know, we sort by voting, and boom, those top couple things we fix. And one, that there's always this C# and VB.NET kind of competition, I guess. People are always upset if you don't have VB.NET samples.
Yeah.
And the first time we did the toolkit, we said, hey, we have to ship this now. So we just had C# samples. And one of the first work items was need VB.NET samples. We're like, okay, let's see what the community says. I think we told, it was on a blog or Twitter, we said, you know, if you really think we need VB samples, please vote. And like all of a sudden, 70 people have voted. We're like, okay, yes, very important. That's the first thing we worked on that day. And so, you know, we've learned a lot that, you know, people are passionate about issues, and when the community aggregate starts saying, hey, fix this bug, we'll listen. And that's kind of fun, for sure.
And so now we talked about bugs, and what about features or new features? You know, is there a way where you get input from the community, say, oh, we really want a control to do this, or, you know, this is kind of functionality that we want?
Yep.
Do they do that via submitting bugs with feature requests, or are there other ways that you
sense
what's out there?
Yeah, when you open a CodePlex work item, you can say it's a feature request, and people can vote on those as well. And then the other way, there's I think it's a user voice community for Silverlight in general. And so people will give feedback about what we're doing well and what we're not doing well. And we kind of take both of those together to look at features. And it's tough sometimes. People always want more. You know, you give them one control and they're like, oh, that's great. And now this control we need as well. And so it's been interesting trying to teach people that, you know, yes, we're not actually this huge, Microsoft's a huge company, but we don't have 1,000 developers standing by to add a control for you. And so I think one of the downsides is that people sometimes will ask for the world and maybe expect us to deliver that. So it's been a challenge when people maybe have different expectations for us.
And it's interesting, when we talked with Jeff Durstadt from Anti-Framework, that was the same thing. It's like, you know, he was explaining that, you know, to add a feature that looks small, but you have to kind of, you know, thread it through all the stack, and here too, right? It has to work in the designer. It has to work end to end, where, you know, it might look like a little feature, but in practice it's not. Talking a little bit more about open source, you mentioned that you kind of adjust your code by having more comments and so on. Do you also try to kind of make the code readable to a larger audience? I mean, like, you know, whenever you write code, right, you can write really compact and clever code, or you can write, you know, simple code that's kind of straightforward, maybe not as, you know, clever as you want, but that more people can understand that. Is that something you pay attention to?
Yeah, it is. Actually, controls are an interesting space, because people think that anyone can write a control. And really, there's a lot of things you do the same every time. You know, they hook up to certain events, you respond with visual state changes. And so we're very concise, though, always trying to do it the same way, because we know that people look at that as kind of a pattern to follow. But then the other thing is that we do try to encapsulate the more complex code, and we'll write helper libraries. And so in our code, we'll call this nice, beautiful, simple API that hopefully our customers will use. And so we've shipped all these extension methods and, you know, I don't know, all these little helper functions that actually we find everyone using now. And it's because we took the really hard problems and came up with a smart solution that people can read, you know, if they want to, but hopefully they just use it. And that's been kind of a nice way that we've kind of given to the community. Because at Silverlight, we can't add 100 extension methods for every scenario, but in the toolkit, sure, we'll add them. Mm-hmm. People will find a use for it, for sure. Mm-hmm. And we have had a couple things. We've had some challenges before with different developer opinions on building controls. And that's been tough to kind of tell people, like, we want to go for simple. We want anyone to be able to understand this.
And was that internally or external developers that had that pushback?
That was actually internal, yeah. So it's always, you know, everyone has an opinion. And some people think, you know, let's go for the most awesome implementation and make that code really tight.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that case, the person lost that battle. But I could see it going that way again, too.
Yeah. And so you mentioned in the beginning that you worked on the kind of unit test framework for Silverlight. Is there any kind of special things that you need to do to test a Silverlight app, where, you know, you want to kind of, you know, move things around, click, and just check whether the UI kind of works?
Yeah. Well, so there's a challenge here that Initially, Silverlight, when it first came out, there was no testing story at all. Mm-hmm. And so I worked with the Visual Studio team to take their metadata for their testing and port it to Silverlight. And then I built this little runner for it. And the benefit was that we actually had the developers and the test team using the same test framework on these controls. And so that was really a nice win because as a developer, often we have a separate test framework. And here everyone was working the same source code, the same way of working of tests. And so we really fixed a lot more bugs, I think, that way. And that was a benefit for the team. As time went on, customers use this framework too. That's cool. But people always said, I want to have UI automation. You know, move that mouse away and move the window around. And it's a really hard problem. I'm not sure anyone at Microsoft solved it completely. There's a lot of really technical. On the Silverlight team proper, we have a thing that will render some XAML. And then we'll actually use like the graphics card to do pixel by pixel comparisons. And this work, it sounds really nice. People are like, oh, we want that. Ship it. And then you look at trying to analyze a test failure there, and it's so time-consuming. You know, oh, there's one little pixel off. You know, what changed? Is ClearType on or not? Just weird little things like this that really, it's really time-consuming. So I think we are really challenged to find a good way to get all the tools out to people. And Visual Studio finally added, most recently, an update that lets you do automation. You kind of click through, almost like the old macro recorder, and it'll generate some scripts for you, and you can just click away in your app. So we're getting there. But I think it's a big challenge.
Yeah. And so for like yourself, when you're writing a code, is that the test framework that you guys are using? Or are there other tools that you use in your daily work for testing? And
It's a mixture, really. We, on the controls team, since we ship all this open source, we try to use that unit test framework because then everyone can run the same exact tests we run. On the Silverlight team for the C++ work, of course, we have a whole different framework for that. And it's really raw. You know, it's right there in the core, helping us assert methods. And it works, but it's very, very specialized. So I think if we shipped it, people would say, this is the most difficult thing to use ever. And so there's kind of, again, this thing where it works for Microsoft internally, and there's a reason we don't ship it. It's because it's a big learning curve, and it's buggy. You know, we need to ship features and not test frameworks typically.
Yeah, and for source code control, what are you using? And like, are you when you put it kind of for in the open source, are you using Git or whatever? And is that different from what you use internally?
Yep. So for Silverlight Toolkit, we use TFS, which is great. It's super easy to use. And CodePlex has all these interfaces, and we just use TFS with them.
Okay.
But they support CDN and all these other things. They're SVN. I use Git on my personal projects just because it's fun, it's quick and easy, to kind of keep track of things I do and samples and blog posts. And then on the team, we use the Microsoft Source Depot for a lot of stuff too. So we spend a lot of time integrating code around, work with a lot of different teams.
And so the control toolkit, how many lines of code am I thinking of?
Oh, no clue, no idea at all. I wish I knew. I'll look it up and comment on this post when it comes out.
And do you have any idea how many controls there are in the whole thing?
That one's switched around quite a bit. So when we started, there were probably maybe 12 initial controls, and we added maybe another 10. But then we took a lot and we put them in Silverlight.
Okay.
And so there's kind of this thing, we kind of incubate them on the toolkit, and then, hey, eventually they get to a great quality point, and we just check them into Silverlight. And so we keep kind of moving that around. Windows Phone, we're doing the same thing now. We're going to find a way to put those into the product.
Okay, so the process is that you put them in the control toolkit first, and then once they are stable and mature and maybe they're found to be useful, then you're moving them into the into the regular product. And so are they then still open source, or does the kind of license change at that point?
We still ship the source. Okay. So there's like the data grid control, which is a super complex control. That one must be... It's probably 80,000 lines of code, just a guess. And that control it was a big undertaking. A lot of developers worked on it, and it's in Silverlight proper right now. But the source code still ships in the toolkit. You can still read every line of it. Even the bug fixes go in there. And so it's pretty open. I'm pretty happy about that. And people learn this is how a really complicated control works as a result.
And so you live here in the Northwest. So what are your kind of personal hobbies and is there anything in particular that you're passionate about outside work?
Well, definitely skiing. That's a classic Microsoft thing to do. I think everyone loves to ski here, which is great. And We've got great beer here as well. So Pacific Northwest knows how to have a microbrew.
So, and are you brewing beer yourself? Or?
You know, I have good friends that do, and so I'll go and I'll watch them do the brewing and I'll taste their product, but I don't have to worry about the cleanup that way. So that's a
It's good pretty thing messy.
Yeah, but it's a great hobby. It's really exciting watching people just, you know, coming up with the right hops and everything, and it's pretty exciting.
And so with skiing, there's a lot of people that go, you know, up to Whistler, and you know, there's a lot of code names that come from there.
Longhorn, Blackcomb.
Exactly. So when you go skiing, where do you go?
Typically Whistler. That's the place to go. And last year we went up for the Olympics, which was a whole lot of fun to see that in person. And yeah, it's funny, you know, you ski down Whistler, then there's the Longhorn Bar and Grill. You know, I assume that's where a product code name came from, and eventually you make your way to Blackcomb. So we do have a fond history of code names there.
Yeah. Of course, Windows 7 was a code name and turned out to be the product name, so there's nothing fun there.
Yes. So where does the word Silverline, to talk about these things, where does that come from?
So if I pull up a source code here, you'll see that there's a file called AG Core. And initially we... Marketing knew pretty early we wanted to call it something.
Yeah.
And first it was called WPF/E. I think it was WPF Everywhere.
Yep.
Yes.
And, you know, that just sounds like a Microsoft name. It's long, and that's no fun. And so I think marketing worked pretty early. They're like, well, Silverlight seems like a great brand, and they must have had a team come up with that. So in our source code, we couldn't call it that yet. And so AG is the chemical symbol for silver. So that's kind of, you know, why there's all these AG core parts in the code. And, if you look at the C, there's tons of, you know, variables prefixed with AG. So that's kind of internally, we've never done a rename on the source code that way. It's AG Core forever.
Yeah. Cool. And so like for Silverlight 5, is that what you're working on a day-to-day basis?
Day-to-day, I'm actually working on Windows Phone now.
On the Windows Phone.
For the most part, yep.
Okay. And is can you speak about what you're working on? If you cannot, that's fine too.
So we're doing a lot of performance work right now. So, you know, the Windows Phone's great, but there's an issue with some apps on smooth scrolling. And, you know, if you look at the iPhone and Android, it's not a problem just our platform. Everyone struggles with it. And so we're trying to find ways to maybe take input and make it more responsive. We're doing a lot of profiling of the code and, you know, little bug fixes here and there, trying to really just get the best perf out of that code. Hmm. And that's a big challenge right now. We're spending a lot of time in the profiler, a lot of time with these test devices, just trying to make it better. Because if we make it better at the platform level, all developers will get that benefit. And right now, there's plenty of things you can do to make your app more responsive, but not everyone does that. So we want to solve the problem at the platform level.
And so another thing on the phone is that you have to think about energy use, which is something usually when you're running, you know, on a client, you don't even think about. Is that something also that you're trying to optimize for, to, you know, minimize or maximize battery life?
Yep. So one thing, if you look at Silverlight desktop plugin, it used to render every single tick. It would say, oh, it's time to render, you know, go do everything. And for the phone, we can't do that. That's too expensive on the battery. And so we've done some work where if there's not an animation happening, nothing's changed in the visual tree, we don't render. You know, the GPU just blitz the same thing right back. And so that's been a big win for battery life. And there's funny stories from last year. At MIX, Scott Guthrie was giving these demos, and I don't know if it's true or not, so it's just conjecture at this point, but there are rumors that the phones didn't have very good battery life. And so there's kind of like an entire table of phones ready to go for demos, because he never knew how long they would go.
Next time.
So we came a really long way this year, and there's people dedicated to battery life. They have these reports on what battery life is, and they can almost say for every check-in, you know, what regresses battery life. And so that's pretty important. We have great tools for that. And it's pretty wild what we've gone to, like, very long lengths to make this performance good.
Yeah. And so since the Windows Phone, there's many different devices that run it. How do you test on these many devices, and do you kind of, you know, find, you know, that there are differences in the way things are rendered, or and how much of the code, you know, is taken care of that?
Yep. Our goal is that developers should be able to write their app once and have it work, but obviously it's a challenge. Some of the devices have different amounts of memory, and so there's this 90 megabyte requirement to get into the marketplace. If your app uses more than peak 90 megs, you'll fail certification. Mm-hmm. And so some developers have struggled because you bring in a couple images, you do a lot of rich things, and boom, you hit 100 megabytes. Yeah. And if you're on a low memory device, you know, there's no real virtual memory there, it's just you're going to go out of memory and you're gone. And so there's some work that developers need to do to take that into account. But, you know, if you, you can ask the device, do you have more memory? And if the answer is yes, you can go party in even more. You know, it's just a lot of things that the device has that are, you know, new learning processes, really.
Now that I think of it, of course, you know, when you kind of, you know, swap the device, you know, and you change the orientation, your UI has to flip. Did you add special support for that, or, you know, can you imagine this, controls that kind of, you know, are changing depending on the orientation?
Yep. So the Windows Phone team did this work as part of this navigation model. So you define like this root frame and then all these pages that go into it. And they hook up automatically to orientation. They'll flip the UI for you. And we've actually built a couple controls kind of as a proof of concept. So like these hybrid orientation controls. You can say, I want this content on the left. If it's in landscape orientation, I want it on top otherwise. And that's something in Silverlight we never did before.
Yeah,
you know, of course. There's never a scenario. You can try to move the 30-inch monitor, but
yes,
it's not so easy.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've done some work there on controls. And most controls stay effectively the same visually, but there's some situations. If you look at the web browser on the phone, in landscape, there's no address bar. Because if you have address bar, the software keyboard comes up, there's nothing to see.
Yes,
you know. And so that's one situation where the designers work together, like, you know what, you just can't have an address bar in that orientation. Flip it, then you change it. And so we're still learning about user experience quite a bit. Developers, in the past, we've never cared. And people are telling us it's so important now.
Yeah, I agree with you, because especially with the phones where people expect, you know, a very slick UI experience, whereas, you know, to be honest, most traditional apps are quite simple in that respect.
A lot of gray buttons.
Yes, a lot of gray buttons, yeah. Hmm. That's the kind of things I write, you know.
Sure.
So when we're talking about, like, programming the phone and program Silverlight, so when you're programming in, so what amount of time do you spend in native versus C sharp, or do you spend all your time in one native?
Right? It's all over the place. So last year, we were getting ready for the phone launch. So in September and a little bit in August, that was all in C sharp, and a bunch of us on the team were actually traveling all over the world, hopping from customer to customer and sitting with their developers and saying, "Hey guys, here's a better way to do what you're doing. Let me help you with that code." You know, however we went about that, we were trying to fix performance issues, but that was all at C-sharp level. And 2 months before that, I was completely in C++, and we were doing all this new, we refactored the parser in Silverlight, and that was a really big undertaking. Three developers full-time on that, pretty senior folks. A lot of fun, but also, like, a big challenge, big undertaking. We had to ship it, and I guess, yeah, shipping's a feature. But that was all C++, and now in my job, I'm at about, you know, 80% C++ right now and 20% C#. And it's amazing. People think Silverlight, it's always C#. And the honesty is, no, lots of native code.
So can we talk about C++ for a little while? Well, come on.
Where do you think I'm going?
Okay, let's hear it.
Charles is like, you know, he's like,
we're going to have to get a muzzle for me to really make this.
No, but he loves, it's like whenever he hears native, you know, Charles gets all excited.
Especially when it comes to the phone and Silverlight.
Yeah.
But that's a different topic.
So what version of C++ do you use? Do you use the kind of latest version with lambdas and, you know, type inference and so on?
So you could take our code back to probably 1990, and it would work great.
Okay.
So from our standpoint, Silverlight runs on the Mac as well, and that's an interesting challenge. If you have, typically in C, you always had your declarations at the top of your method or your scope. In C++, you know, eventually people were able to put it wherever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the C++ that we use on the Mac. And so the funniest thing is to see a guy check in a new Silverlight feature, and, you know, in the middle of his code, he'll just declare a new variable. Works great in the PC, and then all of a sudden the Mac test suite fails. It's like, nope, doesn't even compile. And so we've learned a lot about, well, we need to have like a common subset for our C++. And, you know, we borrow and steal code from Microsoft everywhere. So you need a codec, we take the best, you know, the best implementation we can find, and we can't rely on things. So there's no exceptions in Silverlight, if you can believe it. We're still old school in age results. And so as a coder, it's surprising, right? There's always this, we call it an X result, because we're not Windows only, you know, we're not Mac too, so we have an X string and CX string, interesting, you know, we just name them their alias, but we have a very basic common subset of C, and so some people are surprised by that. It's tough as a developer to be as efficient with it, but, you know, we run everywhere.
So are strings the same on the Mac and on Windows, or are one like, you know, zero terminate and the other one?
Yeah, we have probably like 10 different kinds of strings. Yeah. You know, Teams, we have four different list implementations, and we kind of, we almost have our own STL if you think about it. We do have our own lists, and a lot of that is, we don't want to deal with, you know, differences in the STL between Mac and Windows, so we just have our own. And, you know, Microsoft, we love to build our own code, you know, not invented here, it does happen. So we really do have our own string class and, you know, our own smart pointer class, and that's a little bit of a challenge, and you have to learn how to use it when you start as a developer on the team, but it does mean that, you know, we have a very unique, you know, source code base.
And so it sounds as if you're really using C++, you're not using kind of, you know, C++ as if it was C, you're using templates and metaprogramming.
It's a little bit of both, it really is, and part of it depends on where the code came from. And so, like, the Kodak work, most of that's in C and assembly language, but then we also have, you know, smart pointers, those are all heavily based on templates. We just wish we could use some of the newer language features, but don't have that access at all. Yeah.
Interesting. And for the Mac, is it all C, or do you, or C++, or do you have to kind of also interop with Objective-C, or is it like just pure C++?
There's a small bit of interop that's done at the plugin level. So on the Mac, it's this whole... it's basically this what eventually was the Netscape Navigator model for plugins. Mm-hmm. And so there is some Objective-C to work with the OS in a couple spots. But thankfully, most of us don't touch it. We have a couple guys that specialize in Mac. And actually, an intern a couple years ago, the really smart guy, he implemented this whole thing himself. And I think the code stayed about the same ever since. Nice. Just to show you, like, interns do really crazy things. This guy wrote the Mac plugin for Silverlight, and it's still the same today. That means, though, I don't see Objective-C too much. And that's too bad, because I love learning about new languages.
And so if you look at the kind of browser world right now, there's enormous, you know, development, right? Chrome, there's a new version every 6 weeks, Firefox, IE9. How do you guys keep, you know, Silverlight running when the kind of platform is evolving so quickly?
Well, we have a very smart test team, and so we've been surprised a couple times where, you know, someone will say, hey, there's a new build of Firefox out. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Is it a beta? They're like, no, it shipped. You know, and I think hopefully someone on the test team has, we do have relationships with these folks, but sometimes, you know, builds do come out really quick, and we've been surprised before. We're pretty quick about finding issues and resolving it. We've done some GDR releases, so Silverlight 4 has already had a couple of these general development releases that we'll update on your computer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little bug fix for Firefox or Chrome. And we have a pretty big test team that's working on that. But it's a huge, if you imagine from a test standpoint, a massive browser matrix of, you know, what version of OS X do you have? What version of Chrome do you have? You know, is it 32-bit, 64-bit? We have a lot of things there. So I think people have learned a lot about how to optimize testing. You know, you pick a couple configurations that are, you know, proven good test sources, and you just try to do the best you can with that.
Yeah, and so there's one kind of axis, which is the different browsers, and then as you mentioned, there's the, also like the different versions of the operating system. So how far kind of do you go back, you know, do you go back to Windows 95 or, you know, on the Mac? Obviously you cannot go back, you know, to the PowerPC days, but, you know, how do you kind of decide, you know, what the set of machine or configurations is that you support?
So the PowerPC thing is interesting. We actually used to run on PowerPC. Silverlight 1.0 did support that.
Okay.
And I think for a lot of different reasons, it was clear that Intel Macs were headed that way. I mean, today no one really has those computers anymore. So we decided, you know, we don't support PowerPC anymore. We did it in the past. And that's nice that we don't do that. We also just have, I think it's Windows XP is probably the common subset right now. Mm-hmm. And some Silverlights worked on Windows 2000 for business configurations.
Yeah.
I think we try to, we're not saying you have to use Windows 7 anytime soon. You know, I think we understand there's a lot of different versions of Windows out there, a lot of different OS X versions, and we support most of them.
Nice. And so can I now talk about C#?
Yes.
Okay, good.
But
or maybe you have some more questions about native code.
Well, from a developer's perspective, I mean, the question I would ask you is, I mean, if you think about it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the version of Windows running on these phones is Windows CE 7,
yep.
Which already supports Silverlight for native code. And so if I'm a developer that's been writing Silverlight for native code for some whatever reason, I can't port my app to this phone. I'll have to write it in C sharp. When you guys were making those design decisions, I'm going to ask you just point blank, why did we shut out C++ developers from the phone? I mean, you're a C++ developer. You're on the team.
Yeah.
What?
Let's not
upset marketing, please, because I don't want to get in trouble. But I'll take responsibility for the question.
Okay. So the native code on the device, actually, like the Marketplace app and the Mail apps, are written in native code. But it's not Silverlight, actually. It's called Splash. It's kind of the internal name. And it's also what's used by Zune on the PC.
Okay.
And it's, from a developer standpoint, it's a powerful framework. But it also isn't something that I think we want customers to have experience with. It's not as nice as Silverlight. You can't open up Expression Blend and use it.
Okay.
So I think the determination was, you know what, Silverlight's a really strong platform. We have tons of developers that have been learning Silverlight for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Let's start with that. And I know that people are definitely looking at changing that. People say that they, you know, they have this C++ code for iPhone. Why can't they just use it here? And, you know what, maybe we'll get there someday. But, you know, we're not there yet.
Fair enough.
From a performance standpoint, one misconception, people say Silverlight's slow because it's managed code. And, you know, this is a great fight between people, but not to point fingers at anyone in particular, but the Marketplace app for the Windows Phone is actually, it's written in native code.
Yeah.
And people that feel it, they're like, oh, this is really slow, it must be Silverlight. And that's not the right thing to say. So just to say, you know, credit where it's due, that's a C++ app, and so C++ doesn't solve all the world's problems.
No, it doesn't.
But the new Windows Phone update that people say is finally starting to come out soon, that one actually fixes some of these marketplace issues. So, you know, people fix some bugs in that C++ code.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some sense, you know, there's the code and there's those who implement the code. You can write slow C++ and you can write super fast C#. So the which is faster thing isn't really it. It was the question was more about you have a huge population of programmers and they're not going to learn Silverlight. Maybe they will. Once a million people own our phones, but that's just all. And you know, to be honest, Android, most people are writing Java, so let's move along. But I wanted to ask, because he knows, and he's a C++ developer, and he knows.
Well, thank you for answering. Well, real quick, I will say that when we were building, looking at these Windows Phone controls, it's amazing just imagining building them in C++. I guarantee you, it would take you a week to do what you can do in half a day as a developer, and you know. There's a reason you might want to do C++, but gosh, I worry about so much less than C#. So it definitely has a purpose.
Absolutely, it does.
Yeah. So can I not finally ask my C# question, Josh?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. So when you're using C#, what is your favorite language feature in C#? Or, you know, as compared to C++, and then, you know, I also want to hear the other way around, so what is there in C++ that you miss in C#?
Yeah.
Because, you know, since you have been programming kind of intensively in both, you know.
Well, I think the one I use right now is, you know, lots and lots of anonymous delegates. Those things are fun. And they, you know, all over the code now, when I'm doing async code, a lot of the time I'll use actions and kind of like callbacks. And since you're here, I have to say that, you know, I've used reactive as well. And for me, you know, learning it initially was quite a big, you know, it was a big process, but, you know, it's got power. But for me, I'm sticking to the basics, and I have lots of actions right now. And I think we'll see where that goes. You know, on the C++ side, what do I miss? I miss pointer math's nice. You can write some beautiful code with pointer math and pointer arithmetic, and you just look at C# sometimes, it's like, oh, it's another boring loop. Why can't I use pointers here? And, you know, that's...
Yeah, you can use unsafe.
Yeah, not with the phone. Yeah. I've seen people do that, you're right. Unsafe, yeah. I've seen C# with the pointers, and yeah, it's fun stuff too.
Yeah, I think Eric Lippert has a couple of blog posts about that, actually, so...
Cool.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of C#?
My favorite part of C#, I would say link, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
And what I like about that in particular is that it has, you know, and the kind of expression trees.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at things like Lisp or Scheme, where you can, you know, you can treat code as data, but you have to do that kind of explicitly by quoting, whereas here that's done based on the type.
Yep.
And so you just write your anonymous lambda, and sometimes it's treated as code, and sometimes it's treated as data.
Yep.
And that, you know, it's like a very slick experience where, you know, as a programmer, you usually don't even notice, you know, in which world you are.
And I guess I think about, I've seen people that do a lot of these web service calls, and they're either looking at JSON or XML data, and Link has changed that. Like, the code just is so much cleaner now. And you can start doing these helper methods, they work in the expression trees, and they just, like, things happen really quick, really cleanly, and code looks really simple.
Yeah, and for example, you talked about kind of, you know, having to program the GPU, but there's some interesting work from people from MSR where they take, you know, Link expression trees and they kind of compile that to, you know, to run on the GPU. So it might even be that kind of by going to a higher level language that, you know, we make it much easier for you to kind of, you know, really leverage the GPU and write, you know, because often the GPU, the programming model is different, right? You know, you have to do vector processing and things like that. So if you express that in a higher level way and use expression trees to compile that to the GPU, that might be a good thing.
Excellent.
Very cool.
I think that that's called Accelerator.
Yes, and there's a Channel 9 video on this.
Okay, good. So,
with David Tarditi when he used to work on that team, and then Sid Puri, sorry about your name, man. As the main developer behind it. One quick question on that. How is it that HTML and SVG being computed on the GPU in IE9, not some pimp stuff, how is that not general purpose in the sort of the markup sense for programming the GPU? Why isn't what IE9 does, why aren't we saying with IE9 we have turned HTML and CSS into general purpose programming on the GPU? It's not that general purpose because it's web page related markup and layout.
Yeah.
But still,
sure.
It's pretty incredible. It's way the hell up there as far as abstraction is concerned.
Yeah.
Divs and SVG. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. And apparently there was some blog post recently that showed that HTML5 and CSS together is Turing complete.
But, awesome.
Nice.
But again, you know, the way I look at it is that if you express your transforms using CSS, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just another way of expressing some kind of matrix multiply that, you know, somehow gets then executed on the GPU. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, it's not natural to express that in CSS, or
sure.
Maybe you want to have more control.
Absolutely.
But I think these are all different, and this is what we talked about in the beginning, like, what do you do in code? And what do you do in markup and CSS? And it's like the kind of markup part for HTML.
You mean right. CSS isn't code? It's got curly braces, man.
Okay. XAML has curly braces too.
The same question: is XAML code?
Yes.
And whether XAML is code or not, I think people still don't know.
Yeah.
So I kind of think it is code, and you should see that we do code reviews with it, and we have diffs with that. So it sounds like code to me.
Okay.
No. So is XAML Turing complete?
Oh, I have no idea. I'm not that smart.
Well, sure, but there are kind of control structures in XAML, right?
Or, yes, there are.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so you know, now that we are on this topic, so again, like when you look at XAML and there's like, you know, there's pressure on the markup to become more like a programming language.
Yeah, there is.
So at what point do you guys decide to say, okay, this is enough, because otherwise we will have a kind of complete, Turing-complete programming language with XML syntax.
Yep.
We already have something like that, XSLT. But, you know, and is the and you mentioned also the JSON and XML with respect to the C# object literals. So at what point can you say, oh, you know, we can represent that markup just in code? You know, you see what I mean? Is there's like pressures both sides, and somehow, you know, they should meet somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that's headed. We have, in XAML, there's these custom markup extensions, and people have used them to just do wild things. Silverlight didn't support it, and it was the biggest customer request from people, and we finally added it, and the things people do is crazy. It's definitely headed that way. Some people just have these very interesting ideas for what, you know, everything should be declarative in this model view model world. Mm-hmm. And it's heading that way for some folks. But you know what? I've seen people that love to build apps like the old Windows Forms ones. And they're saying, you know, canvas.top equals 5 and canvas.left equals 20. And then they hook up all their events in code. You know, the apps work fine. So yeah. I don't know if it's personal preference. I don't know if it's generational for programmers. Who knows where it's going? But we'll see where it goes for sure.
And another thing where, you know, there's often tension between code and markup is, say that, you know, I want to generate like a list of, you know, n elements, you know, and I don't want to kind of, you know, write n elements, but I want to, you know, have some kind of pattern that dynamically expands. Is that, how do you deal with those things?
Well, so in Silverlight, there's this huge templating model. And so in declarative markup, hopefully you can do it in code. I've seen it done, but it's very, very verbose. We do have this whole story for just the way that you expand data out into, you know, these, the big visual, effectively everything in Silverlight eventually is part of this visual graphic tree. And that graph is very massive. And I think there's so many different ways to accomplish every scenario there. It's interesting to see when people are first learning how they go about it. And initially people think, they're like, oh, this is a simple little control for applying a template to an item or a list of items. And then someone sees, wait, tree view is that, it's just hierarchical. You kind of take that, you flip it on the side, and every item is a hierarchy of other objects that are expanded at runtime. And I think it's definitely interesting just to see how people approach these problems. And it's changing for sure. People always are blogging new ideas and new concepts, and it's really kind of cool seeing the community sometimes. You know, there'll be a blog post, and as a team we look at it, we're like, oh, you know, I never thought about it that way, but gosh, that just saves 50 lines of code. Really cool. You know, so
awesome.
It's a very cool place.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, one of the viewers will show that XAML is Turing complete. I don't know.
There's a challenge.
There's a challenge. There we go.
Wow.
Or maybe prove that it's not.
Yes. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so, hey, you got any more questions?
I think we're done. This is great.
It's awesome. Great job on the phone.
Yes, we're ending with some homework, and I'm really looking forward to the new version of Silverlight on the phone, and of course Silverlight 5.
Excellent, man.
Yep.
Right. Keep on coding, bro.
We'll do
native
all the way.
Cheers.